Thank you for the introduction and for the chance to talk with you all. Before I really get started, I'd like to start by thanking some of the folks who are involved in this project I'm going to tell you about, and in particular, Dr. Junho Lee, hopefully Professor Junho Lee any day soon, the last author on our paper, which is hopefully coming out published soon, and also the one who, in some sense, originated this idea, and also the one who I'll push all of the really difficult questions about classical electronic structure onto, since he's not here. But with that said, also certainly the folks who actually build and run these quantum computers at Google and all the other folks on the paper as well. So before I really get started, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're actually going to talk about in this talk, or what I'm going to tell you about. So the end of it, and the really juicy part, for me at least, is an experiment that we recently did, actually trying out this new hybrid quantum classical algorithm for quantum chemistry. But before we get to that, I'm going to spend really most of the time telling you about some of the classical work that we're building on top of. I think that one of the things that I enjoyed about this project is that we got to replace only a particular part of a sophisticated classical method for treating quantum chemical problems with a quantum computer, rather than trying to do everything on the device. And so in order to really point that out, we'll go through some of the background on these classical projector Monte Carlo methods. But along the way, I would love, whether we're when we're talking about the background or the experiment or anything, if folks have questions or comments or would like to take us off on a tangent, it'd be great if this was more of a discussion than a presentation, although I realize that's hard with Zoom and all. So with that said, let's get started on talking about these projector Monte Carlo approaches. These are a family of very powerful classical algorithms that people used for treating ground states and thermal states of all kinds of different Hamiltonians. The Hamiltonian that I'm going to be most interested in today is the electronic structure Hamiltonian, where we take essentially the electrons, we fix the nuclei at some point in space, treat them as classical objects pinned in space, and then we're interested in the behavior of the electrons, and in particular, the ground state of the electrons, usually, and in this case, after we've already discretized space. So at this point, when we have this Hamiltonian, we've already encoded all of the physics into this linear algebra problem. And we're interested in finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian, because that's the state that's most involved in chemistry at room temperature. It's often the only one with any significant occupation. So this is the problem that we would love to solve. And there's many different ways to solve a problem like this. But one thing we could imagine doing if we weren't worried about the computational effort is something called imaginary time evolution. And the idea is very simple. If we were to be able to apply this matrix exponential to some initial state that had non-zero overlap with the ground state, we would approach the ground state exponentially quickly. And if we drew a cartoon, it would look maybe something like this. We have our initial state, we have population in a bunch of different energy levels. And as we move forward in imaginary time, we get this exponential suppression. Okay, that would be a wonderful thing if we could do it, but of course we can't handle these exponentially large matrices and vectors, or we perhaps wouldn't care for a quantum computer or even fancy classical tricks. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try to approximate this process. And the way that we'll do that is that instead of representing the wave function explicitly, we're going to represent it as an ensemble of simple objects that folks often call walkers. So these are just some simple wave function form that is small enough, has few enough parameters that we can write it down efficiently, some weight, and then ideally we have some way of manipulating these objects. And so in particular, we're going to need some kind of rule that takes us from the imaginary time tau to tau plus delta tau, that essentially applies a small imaginary time evolution to our walkers, and then we can imagine applying that to our ensemble by just applying it individually to one walker at a time. And then the hope is if we can do something like this properly, that the ensemble average or or in our case, both the time and ensemble average of these things as we continue this process will give us a good approximation to the ground state. And then we can use that to calculate properties like the energy that we're actually interested in and that are relevant for the physics or chemistry that we're exploring. So that sounds good. There's different realizations of this idea. In fact, there's many different realizations and they're appropriate for different problems. A little bit later, we're going to specialize into talking about this particular flavor called auxiliary field quantum Monte Carlo. But in general, you can say a lot about these approaches. In some cases, which is not what we're really going to be focusing on here, but it's important to say, in some cases, these approaches work extremely well. You don't need a quantum computer or even sort of additional tricks beyond this basic setup. Especially if you're dealing with unfrustrated bosons, then one can apply a method like this and get very accurate estimates of very challenging many-body systems. The famous example of the superfluid transition of helium-4 was really first analytically or numerically, I should say, understood by this kind of approach. Also, the Hubbard model at half-filling is an example of another problem where one might think it would be challenging because it involves fermions, but there's some special symmetry in the problem that lets us solve it with these methods. Now, I'll get back to what's challenging about fermions, but I just wanted to call out some examples. Really, whenever we're dealing with either frustration or fermions in general, interacting fermions in general, these methods face a real challenge that prevents us from saying that we've immediately solved the problem that we're interested in. People call that challenge the fermion sign problem. It can show up in different ways depending on which flavor of projector Monte Carlo you're talking about. In our case, what's going to happen is this second bullet point here, which is that things will start out okay, but then the sign that we pick up in the wave function from exchanging two identical electrons, that is going to come and haunt us in a way that eventually leads to a catastrophic cancellation of sort of all of this signal in our calculation. And we're basically left with just noise unless we spend some kind of exponential amount of computational effort. And I'll come back to how that shows up in a minute, but it maybe first it's useful to say something about this particular flavor of Monte Carlo that I'm going to be telling you about. So in auxiliary field quantum Monte Carlo, the walkers are the wave function, the simple wave function pieces that we're using are Slater determinants. So they're mean field solutions to some fermionic Hamiltonian mean field approximations to the ground state of something. Or you could think of them as eigenstates of a non-interacting fermionic Hamiltonian. They're easy to write down and store. So that's one point in their favor. And another point is that we're going to have a really nice way to approximate that imaginary time evolution operator in a way that's going to keep us in the manifold of Slater determinants. These tricks aren't especially important for the rest of the talk, but I just really like the last one, so I'm going to tell you about them anyway. The way that we get that propagator that does what I said, which is keeps Slater determinants as Slater determinants, is that we first rewrite this electronic structure Hamiltonian that I gave you. We take a Trotter expansion of the imaginary time evolution operator. And then the two-body part comes from this V squared here. So it's a sum of some squares of one-body operators. We can use a really nice kind of Gaussian integral trick called the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation to rewrite everything as an evolution in imaginary time by just some one-body operator, some non-interacting Hamiltonian, and then this integral over auxiliary fields, these X variables that we'll also be able to sample. So I think that is a really nice trick, and it's going to be really useful because it does what I said, which is keeps us in the manifold of Slater determinants as we try this imaginary time evolution. But what goes wrong? You know, why haven't we already solved the problem? Well, in our case, what goes wrong is that we do, in fact, converge to the ground state on average, but we converge up to some arbitrary phase. And that phase is going to get randomized over time as we do this stochastic evolution. So rather than a sign problem, we really have this phase problem where we get a combination, a linear combination of pieces of the ground state, but smoothly distributed over the complex unit circle. You can imagine that the consequence of this is that instead of doing something like this cartoon, where we have the exact imaginary time evolution, we proceed smoothly to the ground state as we move forward in imaginary time, we instead get a cartoon like this, where things start out okay, but then as those phases begin to randomize, we get larger and larger fluctuations, and eventually we lose any ability to recover any meaningful information from our computation. That sounds terrible, but we do have a way around it. And it's not going to be a general solution to this problem, but it is a heuristic that has proven useful in a variety of different contexts. And I'm going to tell you about the version of this heuristic that applies to AFQMC, but other versions of it are useful for other projector Monte Carlo methods and have a pretty long history of solving interesting problems. And the place that this heuristic starts is with an approximation to the ground state that we're going to call the trial wave function. So with that approximation, we're going to bias the random walk I told you about, which is this wiggling through the manifold of Slater determinants. And we're going to break this symmetry around the complex unit circle, essentially by forcing the overlap between our walker wave functions and the trial wave functions to be positive. And this is an approximation. It's called the phaseless approximation because we're removing the phase. But it's important to note that this is an approximation and it's going to have consequences that I'll circle back to in a moment. But one thing we can say about what happens when we do this is that we usually get much better energies out of AFQMC, the process of doing this whole thing, than we would get if we just measured the energy variationally of the bare trial wave function. That's important, otherwise we wouldn't be bothering with this at all. There's also some useful limits where things are exact. If we already had the exact trial wave function, there would be no approximation. We would just get the exact energy out of this method. But outside of that regime, and perhaps a regime perturbatively close to that, we can say a lot less about this rigorously, but it does still work very well in practice. So one thing that is important to say here is that classically, the kinds of trial wave functions that folks use in practice, and they do use this method to treat really interesting complex molecules, materials, different challenging lattice models. But the thing that people often use as that trial wave function, that approximation to the ground state, is usually just a single determinant, the mean field approximation to the ground state. And the reason that people do that is because we need the calculation of the overlap between our walker wave functions, which are these arbitrary mean field solutions, and the trial wave function itself. We need those to be able to be evaluated efficiently. And for Slater determinants, we can do that with no challenge. But if we thought about using a more rich, more sophisticated wave function on a classical computer as our trial wave function, our choices are very limited. And in some cases, people do spend some eventually exponentially scaling amount of computational effort improving that wave function. But really, there's not much one can do besides just take a linear combination of these kind of wave functions if you want to improve the trial wave function classically. So it was at this point that my collaborator, Junho Lee, who'd been working on this method in the context of classical quantum chemistry, he and I had been also doing some other sort of less interesting project that also involved the calculation of wave function overlaps, but doing it on a quantum computer with the Hadamard test. And what we realized is that this is a potentially useful place to replace a particular subroutine of this classical algorithm with a quantum one. And the reason you might be interested in doing this is that rather than having this cartoon, if you use a trial wave function classically that isn't quite good enough to approximate your ground state, Sometimes the mean field solution does a great job, even though it's far from the true ground state. But sometimes for more challenging problems, you end up in a situation like this cartoon, where rather than getting the ground state energy, we get something above or below it. Below it isn't an accident here. It's true that this method isn't variational. So if we're in a situation like this and we don't have a good way to improve the trial wave function classically, one thing that you could imagine doing, especially if you have a quantum computer as your hammer and you're looking for nails, is that you could imagine replacing the trial wave function with something that we prepare, some wave function that we prepare on a quantum computer. Of course, we know that we have a variety of ways that people have explored for approximating ground states on a quantum computer. And if you can prepare, if you have a circuit to prepare a wave function on a quantum computer, or if you have a circuit to prepare two different wave functions, it's also very straightforward to approximate their overlap up to additive error with the Hadamard test or with other their various tricks. And so that gives you some hope that you could use one of these much richer and more expressive wave functions as your trial wave function if you had a quantum computer to calculate the overlap. And ideally, what would happen is that we'd take a problem where we're in this situation. We'd upgrade our trial wave function to something that we couldn't afford classically, but we can efficiently treat with a quantum device. And we would end up in this situation where we've improved our estimate significantly enough that we're able to study whatever chemistry or physics is interesting to us. So that sounds appealing. There's a lot of things that you could worry about, and I'll tell you about some of them, and I'd love to discuss the others after the talk. But before we circle around to that, there's another piece of sort of background material, a piece of technology that we're going to need to actually explain how we put together the experiment. And that's this really nice recently developed shadow tomography. And in particular, there's different ways of approaching this, but the experimental protocol is so simple that I kind of just like to start by going through it. So the way that shadow tomography works is that we take a copy of our input state row, whatever it may be that we're interested in, and we apply a randomly chosen circuit or unitary from some ensemble. In our work, we're going to be looking at Clifford unitaries on sort of the whole system, whatever that is, but one can choose other ensembles. So you apply that randomly chosen circuit, you measure in the computational basis, and you obtain some string of bits, and you just repeat that process, saving a record of the unitaries you chose and the bits that you measured. And we call this record the classical shadow. Folks who have been exposed to this part of the literature before, which I imagine is many of you, will recognize that I'm talking about the flavor of shadow tomography developed by Huang and Preskill, rather than the kind of original formulation by Scott Aronson. And I'm talking about it because this flavor of it is going to be really useful for our experimental implementation. It's quite friendly to use on a near-term device. But what does one do when we have this classical shadow? I told you that this is basically the entire experimental protocol. And the reason that this is useful is that we can think of measurement when we perform it in this way as an invertible quantum channel. And the reason that this is particularly useful for us is that this channel isn't just invertible, but the inverse when we use Clifford circuits as our ensemble of unitaries, that inverse has a simple closed form that you can write down. And then we can think of the classical shadow of rho as an approximate reconstruction of rho that we obtain by sampling this expression I have here below. And so what we end up with then is some representation of rho. And the other useful thing about this representation is that we have very strong guarantees about what happens when we use it to estimate the expectation value of different observables. There's different ways of explaining this, but one nice tack, and it was taken in the original paper, is that you can characterize the variance of some estimator that you get for a number of different observables when you use this procedure. You can characterize it by saying that the ensemble of unitaries that you choose defines a norm. And if you do that, you can show, and we're going to make heavy use of this fact, that the number of different samples that you need to estimate m different observables, each to within some precision epsilon, scales logarithmically with m and linearly with that norm. And for the Clifford group on n qubits, this norm is bounded above by the Hilbert-Schmidt norm. And for us, in the context of the thing that we're doing experimentally that I'm about to tell you about, we're going to be interested in estimating expectation values of very low rank observables, constant rank, in fact, with the scaling with all of the interesting parameters in our problem. And so what that is going to mean for us eventually is that we're only going to need to perform a number of measurements that scales logarithmically in M, where in our case, shortly, M is going to be the number of different Slater determinants involved at the different steps in time in our computation. And this is going to be really useful because you can imagine this imaginary time evolution procedure that I told you about. I didn't tell you how many walkers we need, but I said that we're going to be taking some time and ensemble average. So you can imagine that we're going to be starting with a number of these walkers. We're going to be evolving them forward in imaginary time many times in small steps. And we're going to need to measure overlaps with, as a result, tons of different walkers, tons of different Slater determinants with our trial wave function. So if you thought about doing each one of those computations separately on the device, you might be worried that the experiment would become really challenging or perhaps not even possible on today's computers where there's sort of various overheads. But for our purposes, we're going to be able to do something much simpler where we just use a classical shadow to replace all of those separate computations. So with that, I think we're in a good place to actually talk about what kind of experiment we did. And the protocol, now that we have all of the pieces together, is quite easy to explain. What we're going to do is that we're going to characterize this state, a superposition of the zero state on all the qubits, and our trial wave function. And we're going to then approximate the overlaps between phi here, which is standing in for whatever walker that we're interested in, with our trial wave function by using expectation values of these two different observables. These things are low rank, and you can put them together to get this overlap easily. And because they're low rank, we can measure them or we can approximate them using our classical shadow very efficiently, or at least efficiently in terms of the number of samples that we require from the device. There is a wrinkle here where there's an exponentially scaling post-processing step that in this experiment, we just accepted as the cost of replacing the Hadamard test with this much more feasible experimental protocol. One could imagine, and I'd love to discuss it afterwards if folks are interested, one can imagine trying to do something better here that doesn't leave us with that scaling in the post-processing either. But at least everything we need from the classical shadow is efficient in terms of the number of samples and therefore in terms of the time on the device, which we expected to be the real bottleneck in our first experiment here. Okay, so I've said what we do with the classical shadow.
Bill, can I ask a question? Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
So when you talk about scaling, you have this estimation of the overlaps, and the scaling of that with epsilon is 1/ε, where epsilon is the additive error, I believe, in the estimate. So do you expect that epsilon to scale polynomially with the number of electrons, say?
Yeah, that is a really good question. So in general, no. The thing that we really need to get within some reasonable accuracy is actually more like the relative error. And that's because these overlap quantities are going to appear in our computation as ratios. We'll always be interested in the ratio of two different overlaps. And roughly speaking, we'd love to get those overlaps within some fixed relative error. There's a couple of things that make this less disastrous than you might imagine. One of which is that it's very natural, and I'm not going to give you the details during this talk, but I'll just tell you that it's very natural to work only inside some fixed active space with this method. So almost for free, we get the ability to just pick out some small part of the problem where we hope that the interesting quantum correlations lie. And then any of the electrons that we have that are outside of that, that we're treating in terms of the trial wave function, just by freezing them in some orbital, any of those we're able to handle in a way that doesn't affect the kind of epsilon that we would expect to need. And so if the correlation length of the system is finite, then we can treat very large extended systems and not have that kind of scaling. So that's one thing that is going to help us. I mean, in the scaling that the additional computational cost that we pick up for doing that is very modest, which is in some sense an advantage compared to other methods where you might pay a high overhead for dealing with that larger space perturbatively. The other thing that we could hope to do is to modify our Walker wave functions to make them something richer than just single Slater determinants, so that we kick the can down the road as far as what epsilon we would need by making them rich enough that the typical overlaps would be larger. And so ultimately, in a world where we have significantly more powerful but still noisy quantum computers, we think that there is a regime where we'd have a fighting chance at getting some quantum advantage here. And by that, what I mean is treating some system large enough to do something interesting without suffering from this eventual exponential scaling. But there's a lot of work and a little bit of luck needed there, I would say. But yeah, that's a really good question. So that's kind of a fundamental problem in a way that we imagine we can only postpone, not deal with ultimately. But this challenge with estimating the overlaps, the scaling of the post-processing here, it really doesn't seem fundamental. I mean, we could, in a way, just avoid it by using the Hadamard test instead. That would make an experiment difficult, but the scaling wouldn't change so much. But yeah, so there's sort of two separate exponentially scaling aspects to the actual experiment that we did. And now I've pulled the curtain on both of them. So yeah, thanks for the question. That's a good place to talk about it.
Thank you.
Okay, if you are still with me after I have explained how there's not just one, but two exponentially scaling aspects to this experiment, I can tell you about the rest of it. So once we have this classical shadow, if we're not so worried about the cost of that post-processing, then we're in really good shape, because all we need to do is essentially run a nearly standard auxiliary field quantum Monte Carlo calculation. It's very natural to express all the quantities that we need in terms of these wave function overlaps. And that's the quantities that we need both for doing the imaginary time evolution, as well as ultimately estimating the energy or other properties. And so that's going to be useful, because those wave function overlaps are the only thing we're asking out of our device. And then what can we say about this protocol? Well, I like to stop at this point and just kind of look at the cartoon, partly because we put a lot of effort into this figure, so I might as well reuse it when I talk about the project. But the thing that I'd like to highlight again, that this cartoon does a nice job of showing, is that everything we're doing on the quantum device happens here before we do this sophisticated classical calculation. And that is really appealing from the perspective of actually doing one of these experiments, because the difficulty that one incurs when you're doing some kind of feedback between the classical and the quantum coprocessors starts to look really challenging. If, if you add up the cost of that latency and the number of measurements one might have to take. And so this way of designing the experiment, although it has its challenges, gives us a real hope of doing something interesting, even on a very noisy near-term device. So I've given you some of the reasons that we were really hopeful kind of at this point in our construction of this experiment, but before we had ran anything and seen how well it actually, gotten to see how well it actually performed. Because of the classical shadows, we have this modest measurement cost, scaling only logarithmically with the number of different Walker evaluations we need. There's no feedback loop, which also makes the experiment much easier to perform in practice. And then there's a couple of other points here that one can believe or not, but there's at least a hope that because what we're doing is not directly using the quantum processor to evaluate some chemically interesting properties, where you might expect to need a very large degree of precision. You might want things like the energy to one part in 1,000 or better to get at what people call chemical accuracy, so sufficiently accurate to determine things like reaction rates. So because we're not doing that on a quantum processor, and we're just using these overlap evaluations to bias a random walk, you might hope that even if we do things poorly because of noise or insufficient number of samples, that we still have some hope of everything working out well. And then the other thing, which I'm not going to get into in detail, but I'd be happy to chat about offline, is that there's some degree of inherent noise resilience, particularly in the shadow tomography part of this. There's a really nice follow-up work on the initial shadow tomography, sort of NISQ-friendly shadow tomography, that explains how when we do this effectively twirling the measurement, then it scrambles a lot of the noise in the shadow tomography circuit and the measurement into something that looks like a global depolarizing noise. And the end effect of that for our purposes is just to rescale the numerator and the denominator of the ratios that we care about. So we're very resilient to it because of that. Okay, so we have these reasons to be hopeful that this experiment might be successful. I'm going to sort of glance past some of the details of the system that we chose. The most important thing to say about it is that the thing that we started with is a very typical toy problem when you're interested in capturing the difficulty, the flavor of the difficulty that one faces with larger, strongly correlated chemical problems, strongly correlated sort of meaning that they were very far from a mean field solution. But we just picked this as a nice toy problem. And we look at it with a couple of different discretizations of space. And we have some circuit that prepares a good approximation to the ground state. The motivation isn't especially important here. But before I tell you how well it worked, it is nice to show a circuit diagram and to kind of dwell on how many gates we're actually executing on the device. So what we do is we start out by preparing a GHZ state. Oh, there goes my mouse. So I'll have to do without the pointer. So we start by preparing a GHZ state, and then we execute this part of the circuit in the middle that prepares the superposition of our trial wave function and the zero state. This thing preserves particle number, excitation number, which is why it's easy to just push the GHZ state preparation to the beginning. And then we have a bunch of gates at the end that are implementing this shadow tomography protocol. So altogether, we're talking about 70 to 100 two-qubit gates, depending on the experiment that I'm telling you about. And that's enough that you would be worried about having an error in, if you think of errors as discrete events that occur only during two qubit gates, you'd be worried that more often than not, you would have an error when you execute this circuit. So with knowing that, we expect that there's gonna be plenty of impact from noise. There we go, okay. Computer's fighting me. And so, what happens when we actually do these calculations on the quantum device? Well, the thing I'm starting with is showing you what happens when we just characterize these trial wave functions that I told you about. And we say, if we just look at the variational energy of these wave functions, we don't worry about feeding them to Monte Carlo. What does it look like? On the y-axis of these two plots, I'm plotting something called the atomization energy, which is just the energy it takes to pull those hydrogen atoms apart to infinity. But it's basically equivalent to the ground state energy, since we're just taking a difference of two different numbers. And one thing to note about the left-hand side, which is our experiment where we just took a very coarse discretization of space, is that the circuit I showed you on the last slide actually exactly solves this problem. So it's kind of a nice test, because if we had no noise or no measurement error, we would get the exact ground state energy. So everything you see on the left-hand side, there's data from four different independent experiments. All of that is coming, all of the error there is coming from the noise in the device and measurement and perhaps few enough measurements or insufficient number of measurements. But you can see on the x-axis, I've plotted what happens as we take more and more measurements and feed them to the shadow tomography, use the classical shadow with sort of more and more and more samples to do everything. And it looks pretty well converged. So probably we're looking at just the impact of noise there. On the right-hand side, we don't have that property. We are solving in a only on 8 qubits. We're treating a small fraction of this much larger problem, which is the same 4 hydrogen atoms, but in a much finer discretization of space. But there is still some large impact from noise. So we're doing perhaps how well we would expect to. We're quite far away from this orange band, which is the sort of acceptable error that we'd like to be within to get chemical properties well. We didn't do all of the sophisticated error mitigation that you might try to do if this were a VQE experiment, but even if we did, we don't expect on the system with this size and this many gates involved that we'd be able to very easily get the kind of accuracy we'd like. So when we feed, though, these wave functions to the Monte Carlo procedure and we use them to guide this classical Monte Carlo calculation, we see something very different. First of all, the variation between the experiments is essentially erased or nearly erased. And the energies that we get out of the classical Monte Carlo calculation guided by this quantum data is much, much closer to the exact answer. Even on the right-hand side, where we're talking about a problem that's, if we represented it explicitly on qubits, we would need 240. This is what a chemist would call a responsible basis set, where the results might be comparable actually to experimental results. Even there, where we're treating this problem that's reasonably large, but only guiding it with the quantum data from 8 qubits, we're doing quite a good job at solving this thing and getting to within that window of accuracy that we'd like. So when we originally designed this experiment, we imagined that 8 qubits might be a stretch. Experiments are hard. There's many reasons they can go wrong besides an idea being a bad idea. And we thought that we would be struggling to get these kind of results. But actually what happened is that even without the fine tuning from our experimental collaborators, we got data that looked something close to this. And so we decided that we needed to see what would happen as we scale things up. Like, could we do a decent job on a larger system benefiting from the same things we benefited from here? And again, the exact details of the systems aren't that important. We picked another couple of nice examples. The dissociation of a nitrogen dimer is kind of a classic test of small scale test of chemical methods, quantum chemical algorithms. That's a problem that we fit onto 12 qubits. We fit a problem that's a small piece of a diamond crystal onto 16 qubits. And in both cases, we actually simplified the ansatz that we used to approximate the ground state, basically because we were worried that noise would start to overwhelm us at these system sizes. So what happens, first I'll show you the data from the 12 qubit experiment. And there's a couple of things to note. And the first one is that if we look at this blue curve, we can see that we're very far away from, these blue points, we can see that we're very far away from the black curve, which is the thing I'm calling exact. Here we're plotting something slightly different. It's related to the ground state energy. It's that, the difference of that and the energy at some other configuration. And we're, instead of plotting the number of measurements on the x-axis, we're plotting this physical parameter, the separation between the two atoms. And we might expect the problem to get more difficult away from the minimum there, equilibrium, because bond breaking tends to be harder than describing molecules at equilibrium. But kind of no matter where we are on that curve, you can see that the blue points are very far away from the black curve. And if we zoom in to the inset and just plot the error, the blue points don't even appear on that scale. But what does appear on that scale are the red points that are the experimental results that we get when we feed that trial wave function to our Monte Carlo algorithm. So again, I suppose I should clarify, both the red points and the blue points come from the experimental data, but the blue points are just the energy of the trial wave function on its own. And then the red ones are the data that we get when we feed that to the Monte Carlo algorithm and calculate the energy that way. And what we see is that at some of the points, not all of them, but many of them were within this orange band that we said was our goal. And we're also doing generally better than both these green and these yellow triangles. The green triangle and green triangles in particular are the same method, but using the mean field solution as the trial wave function. So it's nice to be improving past that. But really the most interesting thing about this plot is something that we almost missed in preparing this figure originally, because we didn't have the black points, but we decided to include them because they are telling us what would happen in the absence of any noise. If we just took the trial wave function that we intended to prepare on the quantum device and used it with no noise, no measurement error, we just use that exact wave function to drive the Monte Carlo calculation, that these are the numbers that we would get when we looked at the energy that came out of that Monte Carlo procedure. And what we see is that they're nearly on top of the red points, which is telling us essentially that the reason that the red points aren't better than they are is mostly due to the fact that our ansatz wasn't rich enough. We're not yet overwhelmed by the noise on the device. And if we look at the 16-qubit system, there's a similar story. We're performing even a little worse, but we can attribute most of that error, again, to the ansatz that we chose not being sufficiently flexible. So it looks like we do have some room to improve that before the noise on the device overwhelms us. And of course, you know, like any computation on a noisy quantum computer, we do expect a third source of exponential scaling there in some sense, as the fidelity with the thing we would like to prepare drops to zero as we add more and more gates. But the regime that we're in, it looks like we do have further to go. And this was really encouraging because over the years, we and plenty of other folks who do a fantastic job with these different experiments have really tried to push these quantum chemical calculations larger than 5 or 6 qubits. But when we're talking about correlated electronic structure, it gets very challenging to go larger and still get good results out of a noisy device. There's a variety of reasons for that. But we were able to ride this quantum Monte Carlo method to reasonably accurate calculations on much larger systems than we think would have been possible, even using our whole bag of tricks with a VQE type approach. So we were really happy to see this. And it's part of what is encouraging us to wonder how far in practice could we go if we did everything we can to push the challenges of this approach back and perhaps also slightly improved the devices themselves. Although people tell me that that's challenging, so I don't ask for it too much. So I think that's everything that I wanted to tell you about. I am happy to discuss anything from this work or anything else that folks find interesting. But first, I just want to say thank you for listening and for the good questions.
Great. Let's all thank Bill for a really fascinating talk. And I can open it up to questions now. So if you have a question, please just unmute yourself.
Well, I guess I could ask another one at the risk of hogging up all the question time. So Bill, you mentioned that, you know, maybe enriching the set of trial wave functions and also the wave functions for the walkers might help the algorithm. One small question is, I mean, you know, you use these Slater determinants, my guess is that nothing would change if you instead used fermionic Gaussian states, which are a slightly more general but still classically tractable class. Is that something that you considered?
It isn't. I'm not sure what the impact of that would be. I mean, on the one hand, we know that we're interested in the ground state in a particular symmetry sector, but you could imagine that letting, say, the particle number fluctuate away from that might still be a useful thing to do.
So I can just comment that, in fact, like there are examples. So I agree that it's sort of, you might be inclined to say that, you know, for a particle number preserving Hamiltonian, you should consider the particle number conserving fermionic Gaussian states, which are the Slater determinants. But there are examples of particle number conserving Hamiltonians where we can prove that fermionic Gaussian states do vastly better in terms of a mean field ansatz than the Slater determinants, even when the Hamiltonian conserves particle number. And I think that those examples are not like rare or, you know, we have examples, but I think they're well known, like in superconductivity, for example. That happen. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with any work that people have done on that classically, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's been interest in it. I mean, one thing that I would have to think through more is that I'm not sure that you would ever, so the way that you update the walkers comes from this decomposition of the Hamiltonian that itself, I think, should preserve particle number. Maybe there's a different way of doing it, but that you get some effective one-body Hamiltonian that you take a small step in imaginary time under, and it's possible that it hasn't been done because there's not a sensible way of relaxing your requirement that it preserve particle number there.
I see.
I should talk with Junho about that or someone else who really knows the classical side of this much better. It's an interesting idea. The other thing that we've thought about as a potential way to improve the walkers and push back the eventual onset of this typical overlap becoming small, which will cause a challenge, is to take our favorite wave function for approximating the ground state, whatever it may be, and then append an arbitrary either fermionic Gaussian or perhaps the particle number preserving version of those, some arbitrary Gibbons rotation to the end of that. And that would have the advantage that we could update that last part of the circuit in the same way we do here by acting on it with a one-body operator, the imaginary time evolution under a one-body Hamiltonian, and just keep the rest of it fixed so the walker circuits wouldn't grow in time, but we could improve them by improving the first part of the circuit. This is one of those things where I was tempted to do everything for this project and had to remind myself that we should stop. But I am really curious how well that would work. We didn't at all at the system sizes we were working on see the onset of that problem where the typical walker overlap starts to become small. So that was another reason to not worry about it for this first experiment. But
thanks. And thanks again for a really nice talk.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the questions. Yeah, I'd love to hear from other folks, even if there's something that is sort of just an interesting thing to talk about that's a divergence from the talk.
Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I have a short question about this shadow tomography.
You talk
about classical shadows. In what sense it is classical? Can you elaborate? Because I'm totally new to this concept of
shadow tomography. So it's classical in that it's some representation of the quantum state that we can use entirely offline after we've done the experiment to evaluate different expectation values. So we didn't even have to know which observables that we were interested in. So we didn't, in our case, we didn't need to know the parameters of the walkers when we did the experiment. We were able to evaluate those expectation values classically using the classical shadow subsequently, after we'd collected it, and then once we decided on which observables were of interest. So I think that that's part of the name, but it's also just a classical representation of the quantum state. It contains enough information to reconstruct some different expectation values. I would encourage you to check out that paper, the original one from Huang and Preskill, and or the robust shadow estimation that followed it up and explained how it works under the presence of noise. I found both of those really fascinating, and it was nice to have an excuse to use those tools for something chemistry related.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe another question along those lines. So it's amazing the kind of the robustness to noise you're showing in those results. I mean, are you doing any error mitigation, or is it all coming from this inherent robustness of the experiment and of the shadow tomography?
We're doing nothing that I haven't told you about as far as error mitigation. We benefit from, quite a bit from the shadow tomography. I think twirling our readout error, correlated or not, essentially. And under some assumptions that also the noise that happens during the circuit that does the shadow tomography, to a very good approximation, it makes everything look like global depolarizing noise. And that, at the end of the day, what that does for the observables we care about is just rescale them all by the same constant factor, which might increase the statistical noise a little bit, but we took enough measurements to hammer that down anyway. So we benefit quite a lot there. And then the other thing is that by construction, the walkers stay in the right symmetry sector with respect to the particle number and the Z component of spin. And so even if the thing we measure on the quantum device has some, we measure some occupation outside of that symmetry sector, it's sort of invisible to us. So we get something that looks like post-selection on particle number and spin, also built in a sense. So I think the combination of those and the fact that the Monte Carlo algorithm is tolerant to the trial wave function being qualitatively correct, but not quantitatively, all of that comes together to make it work quite well in practice. Yeah, I think after thinking about readout error in the context of another project and how one has to very carefully deal with it, it's given me a new appreciation for the classical shadows where you get some of that for free.
Great, thank you. So very interesting. Okay, do we have any further questions? Okay, if not, let's all thank Bill once again for a fantastic talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time and the invitation. It was great to be here.